Game On on 2FM.
Damien O'Mara and Donna Co-Callan here with you till Tara Stewart at 7 o'clock. It's the 8th of July and this is Game On.
On the way between now and 7 o'clock, Ryder Cup captain Padraig Harrington on a pleasure deferred as the event moves to 2021.
Hi, European Ryder Cup captain Padraig Harrington here. Without question, the fans are an essential part of that. They create the incredible atmosphere that makes the Ryder Cup so special. So with today's decision, we can now look forward to playing the Ryder Cup in all its glory next year.
Republic of Ireland manager Stephen Kenny tells Tony O'Donoghue what sets him apart.
I'm sure it was, but I'm the only manager. I'm the only group of managers that ever lived in Ireland. And I think that's the difference with us. With, you know, myself, Keith Andrews, Damien Duff, Rudy Higgins, you know, all live in Ireland.
We'll also be asking if we can really expect to have a French Open and US Open in tennis this year.
Game On on 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM and we'd love to hear from you, especially if you've seen any inter-county teams out training. Damien, how are you getting on?
I kept a keen eye out in the car on the way home and I've not seen any inter-county teams out training.
It's turning into a sport in itself, isn't it?
Would you snitch them? Well, it depends who it was, Dunica. Let's be honest now. If you went and saw the Cork hurlers training, you wouldn't say a word. But
no,
if it was Tipperary now or Limerick, you'd be...
As for that Kerry crowd, I'd be standing outside every place trying to keep an eye out for them. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what goes down. But, Damien, it's been busy, hasn't it? Sports back with a bang.
Yeah, and let's hope, like, you know, come here, I don't want to be negative. I'm trying to be realistic. Let's hope it's a prolonged return of sport and it's not like the little... bit of green shoots before the second wave of anything arrives. Let's all be sensible. Let's all hope that it's the dawn of the return to normality.
Yeah, absolutely. It was sad news today, though, to hear about the Ryder Cup, but probably the right decision.
Well, I tell you, we get straight down to business and talk to the man who knows far more about this than I know about. And Greg, I've got you on the wrong microphone, so bear with me one second. See, I'm actually... Oh, here, hang on there now. I've got you on the right mic. Now you can stay where you are. I've often said to people, it's like trying to fly an aeroplane and do open heart surgery at the same time. Greg Allen is in studio.
Don't flatter yourself.
Yes, completely agree.
Jesus, thanks. If you saw the flashing lights and the
buttons
that are
here... There's one giant red button, Damien. You hit that and you're away.
Do you know what? They changed the keyboards. Actually, no, it is. It's gone red again. It was white last night. Greg Allen, I'm just going to ignore all that slagging and everything else that's gone on and get straight down to business. Dunica's alluded to it there. A massive decision. The Ryder Cup, the latest of the big international events, to be deferred down the line. This was an inevitable decision, but equally, when you get stuck into it, it was inevitable that it was going to take some time for it to be made.
There were so many factors, like every big event that's having to be shoved off the calendar into the next year, the following year, in the last 4 months that we have seen. There were lots of elements to this, not just the fact that the players didn't want to play in it. The Ryder Cup captain for America, Steve Stricker, said he didn't want it to be held in his home state without fans. I mean, the one Ryder Cup that he gets a chance to be the captain of the US team for, and he would have had no fans. And, you know, colleagues of mine have written things far more erudite than I'm going to say. One of them, of course, my good pal in the BBC, Ian Carter, he said that these golfers had no interest in generating roars and cheers that would only be heard in living rooms. I think that's really sums it up. The players play in the Ryder Cup not for money. They playing it for the glory, for the moment. I always remember Graham McDull when he won the US Open in 2010. You know, the greatest individual crowning achievement of his golf career. But ask him what was the best moment of 2010 when he defeated Hunter Mahan in the critical singles in Celtic Manor to give Europe a 14.5-13.5 victory. The crowd around that green on the hill over the 16th that just literally went mad when he holed about a 17-foot putt, and on the following green he won that match, and that meant that the Ryder Cup was won by Europe. And that was the moment he picked from the year, not his US Open win. That just tells you everything you need to know about how the Ryder Cup just gets into the fabric of the players' being and makes them unselfish, makes them want to play for each other. And without the fans, that just doesn't happen in the same way. So it wasn't inevitable. They were looking at restricted amounts of fans. They were looking at behind closed doors. They were looking at all prospects of how to keep the event on the schedule this year. But eventually it came down to the fact that without... the one event in golf that you can't stage without fans is the Ryder Cup.
It's amazing you say that, Greg, because watching the golf at the moment, it's brilliant viewing at home. But you're right, it's the experience, isn't it, for the players? It's the pinnacle of their career. they deserve to have the fans there.
Yeah, you know, it's one thing to have the Rocket Mortgage Classic and the Heritage Classic, you know, all to be staged, you know, without fans, because, you know, say in some of these, those are very good golf courses that they, those last two PGA Tour events were staged on. And in a way, the fact that they were very good golf courses took your eye away from the fact that there were no spectators. And the Ryder Cup, it could be played in a municipal course and it'll still be as exciting as it would be if it was staged on a great golf course, which Switchling Straits is, because the fans frame the event like no other in golf. So it's the right decision. Having said that, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, next year, Thomas Bjorn has expressed this fear. Who knows? Will we be able to have a Ryder Cup in 2021 with fans? And there's already a survey about the Olympic Games done among Japanese people where 4 out of 5 don't believe the Olympic Games is going to happen next year. So, you know, pushing it a year down the line gives it a chance, but who knows? This could roll on for longer than we think.
Well, let's get reaction from as close to the Ryder Cup as we can get. The 2020 Ryder Cup captain, European Ryder Cup captain, who will now become the 2021 European Ryder Cup captain, Padraig Harrington, has been chatting to Greg.
And Padraig, this news, as long as it's taken to actually come to this point, a mixture of disappointment perhaps, but must be some relief.
Yeah, definitely both feelings. Disappointed, and as you said, this is coming for a number of weeks, for sure. But now that it's actually happened, certainly I've been waiting on the news for the last couple of weeks. It's certainly relief at this stage. It was, you know, the decision is taken purely on health and safety. There's no doubt about that. You know, the setup of the golf course, the workers would have had to gone in at this stage, and you can't ask anybody to go out in these conditions necessarily. And so for health and safety, they made the decision, but there was many complications behind the scenes that really would have made it very difficult for me as captain to go there with the team I wanted to go there with.
Now, the big question, of course, at this point is, had there been a Ryder Cup without fans, what would it have been like? It's the one golf event which you cannot imagine without fans.
I'm not saying that was... Well, it was a big factor. I'm not saying it was the actual overriding factor, but I think the PGA of America, Ryder Cup Europe, had to consider that the players didn't want to be there without the fans. The fans certainly didn't want to not be allowed to go. And if you're talking to anybody here from Europe, nobody was travelling. Nobody was going to go over to it. Nobody was going to have to. At the moment, like it's 2 weeks quarantine. It's like a 5 week trip if you wanted to go. So nobody was going to travel to the Ryder Cup and they would have missed out. So I think for the fans and the players, we didn't want the Ryder Cup without the spectators. And it's a great thing. I think it shows as well from our perspective how much we appreciate the fans. You know, I think over the years, people would often say, yeah, it's great with the fans. But when it comes down to it and the reality that we could have been there without it, I think the players spoke out and said they really do play the Ryder Cup for the glory of it. You know, there's no money involved in it. You know, players don't get paid. They play because of the glory. And when you see, and if you go back over all the European wins, let's say, you see the celebrations from the Europeans on the golf course when they hold putts. They're totally out of character from their normal, you know, normal tournament golf. And they're like, you know, Frankie Molinari or Tommy Fleetwood from the last one. You know, you see the reactions. That's not like their character at all when they're in a normal event. So I think that's being highlighted now that, you know, without the fans, it just wouldn't be the same. It wouldn't be a Ryder Cup.
So what now? Because there is implications for the qualification process, and this is one of your big tasks, is selecting your team. You're still going to have 3 wildcard picks, but the qualification process is frozen now.
Yeah, you know, I'd say up to 6 weeks ago, we were full steam ahead trying to get organised for, you know, what the team is going to look like in 2020. I think over the last number of weeks, you know, we're starting to come more to the conclusion that this thing is going to be difficult to go ahead. So we have been looking into what would look like if we move to 2021. And I think it's very reasonable. In Europe, we've suspended the point system. Basically, we don't want to force any player to have to come out and try and compete at this moment. If he doesn't feel safe or comfortable travelling, he can stay at home and will not lose out in terms of the Ryder Cup qualification. It's going to all start again in January 1st. And hopefully things will certainly be clearer at that stage. So players can make their own decisions on what they want to do, and the points will start up, and we'll have a team come 2021 that will have a mixture of experience and current form. And I think it was going to be difficult to have that current form coming into this Ryder Cup if it went ahead. Some players might not have played, some players might have only played a couple of events in Europe. So the one thing with the European team we've done over the years is we've had great rookies. You know, the rookies who come in current form, they play their way into the team. They bring such a spirit to the team. And that possibly was going to be missing this time round. You know, if you didn't have current form, what were you going to do? And some players just are not getting a fair crack at a whip if it was in 2020. But everybody's going to have a good chance. And also, anybody who's earned points up to now, they're not going to lose out. Those points are going to continue on and be kept.
Paulie, there was this thing as well, and you mentioned the players not really wanting to play in front of no fans. And when Rory McIlroy, the best player in Europe, and Brooks Koepka, the best player in America, both said that really they didn't want to play in the Ryder Cup, do you think that had an effect on this decision?
I think the PGA of America and Ryder Cup Europe did take all opinions of all the stakeholders, and there was an awful lot of stakeholders, not just the players, probably the people who moved the most for the PGA Tour. They're in the dominant position in golf, and sometimes they can be, people would often think they're a bit overbearing their position in golf, but they moved the most in moving the President's Cup. And I think, you know, everybody was considered, everybody was taken into account. They made the right decision based on health and safety, but yeah, it would have been, they could have also gone down the road of, look, the players don't necessarily want to have to, you know, go out without the fans. As I said, we play, every player plays in the Ryder Cup. You might know it going into the Ryder Cup. And even in some years, we've seen players come into the Ryder Cup who've just won a FedEx Cup and won $15 million, I think, the last time round. Like $15 million. And he's turning up the following week for no pay, nothing. And the minute he gets there, the buzz, the excitement, the adrenaline, it's just a completely different experience the Ryder Cup, and that's all created by the atmosphere. And you know, the atmosphere can be divisive, there's no doubt about it, the highs and lows of it, but it really lends itself to excitement, and the players aren't used to that. You know, we might get that, you might get it, the odd tournament that you're leading coming down the stretch, you're feeling nervous, you're feeling, you know, that buzz. But in the Ryder Cup, you're getting it for, even in the practice stage, you're getting it for five competitive rounds, three practice rounds. It's like a football atmosphere, and we're just not used to it. And the players, you know, when they reflect on each Ryder Cup, that's what they're really looking back at, the excitement that they got out, the adrenaline rush, and the experience that they can't get anywhere else.
There's one small silver lining in all of this. Adair Manor in 2027, which is now going to be the year that it's going to be held, 1 year later than originally scheduled. It's the centenary of the Ryder Cup 2027, and it's going to be in Ireland.
Yeah, you know, it that's great news for Ireland. And it is probably appropriate that we're back in the uneven years for the Ryder Cup, considering it is the 100-year centenary. I think, it's a nice plus. All the stakeholders had to move. Each course that's been nominated, you know, for the away and the home games, there was a lot of negotiations behind the scenes. There was a lot of things that had to be moved around. And, you know, hotels and accommodations and all sorts of things are already booked for those tournaments down the road. And like I even heard there that, you know, you think of the President's Cup next year, they've all their logos made up. They're going to have to change all that, the dates. There is huge complications behind the scenes. But I definitely think, considering the situation, it is a bit of a bonus for Adair in 2027 that there will be the centenary of the Ryder Cup.
And finally, Padraig, for you, you were named Ryder Cup captain in January of 2019, and you're going to be going all the way to September of 2021, hopefully. Nearly 3 years of your life devoted to being Ryder Cup captain. How is it for you?
Well, I hope I've done most of the work. we were just, when this all started off in March, we were just getting into the nitty-gritty of what form are the players in. Previously, for the previous year, it was all administration stuff, everything that you could do with administration, whether it was what colour clothing we're going to wear each day, all the nitty gritty that has to be done. Now that's going to stay the same. I hope I don't have to do any more on that. So from January 1st, I'll get, you know, the next 4 or 5 months off. But January 1st, you know, we'll be back to looking at the form of the players, who matches up with who's a likely partnership, and who's going to play with who in the months leading up to, who am I trying to get to build a relationship with a rookie. That sort of stuff is going to happen, which I was missing out this year. Like there's players in that team that wouldn't necessarily know each other that well, and that's not great for a Ryder Cup. You want to build those bonds, and even with me, I'm obviously slightly older than some of the younger guys, and you know, I wanted to build that bond, and I was relying on this 6 months coming into the Ryder Cup to just give a little bit more of myself, which wouldn't be something I would normally do. I'm quite a competitive individual at golf events, and I was, you know, not resigned, but I was committed to spending a little bit more time with the rookies and getting to know the rookies and building that relationship. And that all fell by the wayside. Like, we had dinners planned, we had events planned through the last 6 months. So hopefully next year I'll have a good run out of 9 months where I can, you know, build those relationships with my team. And we know it's very important for us in Europe that we go in there with a very strong bond in our team. And, you know, given a better run into it, I think that's possible.
Paddy Carrington, best of luck onwards towards September 2021, and the very best of luck. And after this news today that the Ryder Cup is postponed for 1 year, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Greg.
Greg, you have a great relationship with him there, as we've heard. But as you mentioned to him, 3 years of his life, it's all consuming. How do you think he's about it?
No, I think he's fine about it. I mean, it's a huge relief because it's been a fairly long gestation period to getting this announcement today. And I could see the relief in his face, to be brutally honest. He was in great form today. You know, it's an exciting part of his career. Padraig has pretty much done it all as a player. He's won 2 majors. He won 3 majors in 13 months. And this is a new challenge for him. And when he stepped into the challenge of becoming Ryder Cup captain for Europe, he did so with a little bit of trepidation because he'd seen his really great pal, Paul McGinley, do this stonkingly wonderful job in 2014. And he kind of must have started thinking, can I do as good a job as that? And the difference being, of course, that Padraig has a career already, which is a great career. And, you know, a Ryder Cup captaincy, which doesn't turn out well in the end, maybe the result, maybe the event, I don't know. There is a certain risk to your career that you take. But he seems to have really embraced the fact that this is a really interesting part of his career as he goes from being a player in the PGA Tour to now becoming, obviously, after the 2021 Ryder Cup, he will step straight into the Champions Tour in America. So it's a nice bridge between the two careers.
Yeah, Damien and Ruby touching on it last night with Gary, but this could open a window for the Irish Open, couldn't it?
Yeah, the Irish Open will now probably go into that date of the Ryder Cup. And when I say probably, as far as I know, it's going into that date of the Ryder Cup. Today was not the date to announce it, but I'm expecting that announcement in the next few days. It comes with, you know, some risk, because if quarantine scenarios remain as they are, and they could, for all we know, it would mean that there's 3.5 days from the end of the US Open in America, in New York, to the start of the Irish Open the following week. 3.5 days, and we know what the quarantine situation is right now, so that could mean a struggle for the three Irish stars, Rory McIlroy, Shane Lowry and Graham McDowell, who'll be playing in the US Open, coming back for the Irish Open. And Graham McDowell is the host of the Irish Open, and Lowry, you know, is a former winner of the Irish Open, as is Rory, so it's not a perfect week to stage the Irish Open.
Hopefully we'll have a Dubai Duty Free Irish Open. Hopefully now in 2027 we have the Ryder Cup in Adair Manor for the centenary. So when you consider all the great Irish chapters, you know, Paul McGinley, Graham McDowell, those images of Darren Clark, like Philip Walton, we can go back even further than that. It'll be brilliant for Ireland and for Irish golf to potentially have such a special Ryder Cup in a couple of years' time.
Yeah, in 100 years, the Ryder Cup has come such a long way. And really, it's since 1983 that the modern Ryder Cup has become what it is, when a European team went to Palm Beach Gardens in Florida and ran the Americans to within a point. And then in 85, they won that match so famously at the Belfry. And that's the beginning of the new Ryder Cup era, which will be at its centenary in Ireland, in a most wonderful venue at Adair Manor. And it is every bit possibly one of the greatest venues that will ever be staging a Ryder Cup in the centenary year. That's the one silver lining in what is really disappointing news today.
Okay, Greg, thanks. As always, Greg Allen joining us in studio. We've 3 games ongoing in the English Premier League. Manchester City leading Newcastle by 2-0, 21 minutes in. Gabriel Jesus on target with the opener in the 10th minute. Riyad Mahrez has just added a second. Scoreless between Sheffield United and Wolves. Scoreless likewise between West Ham and Burnley. We're going to stick with soccer after the break. We're going to hear from the new Republic of Ireland manager, Stephen Kenny. That's on the way.
Game on, soccer.
Okay, welcome back to Game On. As we said earlier today, Tony O'Donoghue caught up with Stephen Kenny, and he began by asking him how he's managing to actually scout players at the moment.
That's been a little bit frustrating, of course, but I think, listen, it's a great opportunity as well. You know, with the beauty of Y Scout is that you can watch all of the games, and, you know, I think it gives us, all of the coaching staff, a chance to analyse all the games, scrutinise all the games, check everyone's current form. Some players have played more than others, and so we've been able to see all of the games really.
But it's no substitute, I guess, for actually going to a game and seeing it with your own eyes.
Of course not. No, it isn't. But listen, you have to maximise everything you can. I think what we've done is we've been able to. It's given us great time, myself, Keith Andrews, Damien Duff, Rory Higgins, to watch all the eight games from our own qualifying campaign, then to watch the Bulgaria's qualifying campaign, Finland, Pukki scoring 10 goals for Finland qualifying for the Euros, then we see Wales to watch all of their games at the Nations League, and of course even more importantly Slovakia, because they have a very consistent selection, and that's a very important game, very significant game in October. So we've eight games to look forward to, and we're looking forward to them.
What about the logistics? Have you got clearance to travel? I mean, how are you going to get to Bulgaria to start with?
Well, I think, listen, we have a very professional team in the FAI who will manage that, and I'm sure that's not going to be an issue. I think it's a quick turnaround. We get the players in on a Sunday. They may have even been playing league games on a Sunday. We don't know yet. And then we fly in the Tuesday. So it's so quick. And it's a 9:45 kickoff at night, the Bulgarian game, which is itself is unusual. So that's the first game.
And in terms of your players being fit and match fit at that point, the way that the seasons are being, you're not going to have many players with too many games under their belt at that point, are you?
No, nothing is perfect. But you've got to make the best of everything you can. I mean, you know, Pales is into insignificance. Like 1,700 people have died. It's been an absolute crisis. So obviously players have had to modify their training programs, and one season joins into the next, and that can be difficult. But I think our game against Bulgaria will be, for a lot of them, their first game in the pre-season nearly, or maybe they will have played one league game depending on the start dates. So it's it is early, but listen, we'll maximise everything we have. We'll make the, you know, we're positive about how we'll approach things. I think very exciting, an opportunity in the group of Bulgaria, Finland and Wales, and of course the game against Slovakia. So yeah, we've lots to look forward to.
The League of Ireland, though, will be in full swing, hopefully, by then. And will that give players from the League of Ireland maybe a little advantage in terms of your thinking?
Well, it's been very difficult for the players in the League of Ireland, you know, at the moment. I think, obviously, summer season, the season's been fractured, you know. And I think, it's a shorter season. But a lot of the players have a lot to look forward to. Bohemians, Keith Long, Bohemians, their first year in Europe. In many years, they look forward to that. Dundalk, of course, are seeded in the Champions League, which is terrific. And Vinnie Peart and Stephen Bradley at Shamrock Rovers will be determined, having had, you know, European experience last year. And Declan Devine, they're getting back into Europe. So all of the players, they have a lot to look forward to. I'm delighted the FAI Cup is, because there was speculation that might lose out this year. It's very great tradition, the FAI Cup, and very important. Great day in the Aviva Stadium, and I think it's very special that's going again.
The likes of Jack Byrne has already been in squads, of course, so he'll expect or hope certainly to be in your thoughts and in your squads.
Yeah, certainly my thoughts, and I think he's a very talented player. He's different player with his range of passing. So a lot will depend on between now and then. It's a long way away. And a very competitive area. The midfield is probably our most competitive area, and the most, very, very competition for places it'll be interesting to see.
When you look at the players that have been important to Republic of Ireland in recent games, and you see the form, the likes of John Egan scoring a great goal this week, and how well he and Enda Stevens and David McGoldrick have played for Sheffield United, it's important, I think, from an Irish point of view, that they continue to do well.
Yeah, it has been. Sort of getting players at clusters of clubs now. Sheffield United have been absolutely outstanding, and John Egan, obviously great goal, it can only boost his confidence. And the Stevens, Dave McGoldrick, both had really strong qualifying campaigns for Ireland, and I think Brighton, of course, players emerging at Brighton, Burnley, so these are the clubs that have been significant. Southampton within the Irish squad.
Southampton, you look that Shane Long has got back into form and, you know, featuring regularly. Michael Obafemi, Smallbone, Will Ferry as well.
Yeah, well, you know, obviously I've seen a good bit of Will Smallbone and Will Ferry, but they've not been in the 21s. They've had injuries last year, and they've made good progress. I'm excited by the two of them. We've had Michael in as well into the under-21s, so it's... And it's good to see Shane Long back playing. So you want competition for places. That's the essence of, you know, what you want. And I think that that's very important that we have that in all areas.
Can I ask you about Jeff Hendrick? He's been linked with a move to Italy. How important is it that he gets a club quickly and can get in shape for you for September?
Yeah, well, I'm sure Jeff has, got good options. And, he's at the prime of his career and he's a free agent. So, you know, he'll make the decision I'm sure it's been uncertain with the COVID, and that's probably affected things in relation to a lot of clubs. And he probably would have had greater clarity without the crisis, but that's he won't be short of options, I'm sure.
Can I ask you about your situation with the FAI? You're now part of the executive, as I understand it. What does that mean exactly?
Well, to be honest, Tony, my position's not changed, really. I'm the manager of the international team. That's all I ever wanted to be. I think the thing is, I always have since I've been appointed here as under 21 manager, I always have a strong voice on football issues. I think the international teams should be the centre of the FAI, you know, and I think at all ages should be very prominent. And I think the national leagues, amateur football, and the, you know, the school of boys and girls, I think it's football should be at the centre of the FAI. I think we need more football people contributing to decisions that are made, and I think I'll certainly nothing has changed because I've always had a strong voice. I think chief executives maybe recognised that and said, you know, any time you want to come in and voice your opinions, there's a seat at the table for you to do that.
But that was never the case before for the Irish manager.
I'm sure it was, but I'm the only manager. I'm the only group of managers that's ever lived in Ireland. You know, you can't do it from another country. And I think that's the difference with us. With, you know, all the other managers have lived in other European countries. You know, myself, Keith Andrews, Damien Duff, Rudy Higgins, all live in Ireland. We'll be working here all the time, every week. We'll have a video analysis room installed here in the FAI. We'll be monitoring all the players. Obviously, we'll be in the UK and elsewhere watching matches. But it's a different dynamic. We've from 15s to 21s right through to the first team. We want a cohesive working environment where players can fluctuate up throughout the age groups, and we can promote players throughout the age groups and into the first team. So it's not as it was before.
Can you see yourself being drawn into, you know, issues then around the league though?
No, not really. No, my job.
How do you feel, for example, about the clubs that were finding difficulty with going back? You know, some clubs were saying that, you know, it might present them with an issue. It might put them under pressure even for their very survival.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to all the clubs in their different environments, you know, traditionally underfunded. I think you've got clubs who are looking to difference. Some clubs are looking to make their mark in Europe. Dundalk, Rovers, Derry, Bohemians this year. Some clubs are trying to qualify for Europe. Some clubs are just trying to exist, you know, and I think because they're maybe going through a period. So it's... It is sympathetic towards the players. They've had a tough period, and I'm hopeful that the league will finish strong, and that we can look forward to the football starting again.
But can you see yourself being dragged into some of those issues?
No, that's not my remit.
Can I ask you about the Robbie Keane situation? Has that changed at all? Because he's no longer working with Middlesbrough. He's still a member of the FAI staff as such, isn't he?
Listen, you asked me that question the last time, Tony, you know, and I just said to you, I'll give you the same answer. Like, I have huge respect for Robbie Keane, and he's been, you know, an incredible goal scorer for Ireland, and I'm sure he'll have a great career in management. He's a strong, you know, strong person. You know, he won't be short of options, I'm sure.
But the fact that he's available and his experience in the game and what he's done for Ireland today, as it turns out, happens to be his 40th birthday as well, and the FAI tweeted that a little bit earlier, and as did FIFA. Do you see any role for him at all?
Well, Ruud Doctor, you know, is our technical director. He makes the appointments in relation to all the positions. But from my point of view, I have my own team with the senior team, We appointed Keith Andrews as my assistant manager, and who I worked with the under-21s for 18 months. And, you know, so that's where it is.
Right. And I'll ask you about another Keane, finally. Roy Keane recently had a few words to say about your assistant, Keith Andrews. How do you feel about what he said?
Listen, we all live in a, you know, society where people are free to express their opinions. You know, that, I'm fine with that. I think Keith is... I found Keith to be very hard working, diligent. It hasn't come easy to him. He's had to go and work with the under-16s, the under-17s, and then the under-18s for 18 months there. And he was promoted to the under-21s, did another 18 months with the under-21s, and has got through all his license, pro license holder. Has worked with MK Dons in the Championship in League One as a coach. And I think he, I found him very diligent, hard working, great analysis. And a very, very good coach, and he'll have a great future, I feel, within the Irish setup.
So, why do you think Roy would want to say that?
No idea.
Stephen Kenny chatting to Tony O'Donoghue earlier this afternoon, short and sweet at the end there. And Donica, it's interesting, like he's talking there about the fact that it's the first time an entire management team will have been based here, and obviously Brian Kerr lived here in his time in charge, but. Like the expectation level is going to be so high, but equally the goodwill towards Stephen is so big, but that will all only last so long.
Absolutely, and he's right in that interview with Tony mentioning having football people in the right areas, and I think that's what we've got. He's entwined in Irish football for years. He knows it inside out. You hear him speak so well about the League of Ireland. But just from judging from the outside, it's important to have people with expertise in the other areas that maybe he's not so strong in, you know, and I think maybe that's where the FAI. But I did find it interesting, Damien, and you probably give me a better take on this, but Tony asking the hard questions, like just
that's his job.
I know it's his job, but he's right in front of him asking about the Roy Keane, Keith Andrews scenario, the Robbie Keane. It's tough.
But you know, the most important thing is he asked it in a respectful way.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, and you notice that in your game, you'd know this better than anyone. There's a respect earned, isn't there? And Tony certainly has that.
But you see, I think, and even like, and I often, I've sympathy for managers in a day like today where I don't know how many interviews Stephen Kenny must have done today, but he must have done hours of media. And the flip side of that then is, how many occasions did you suffer a bad defeat and all of a sudden a media officer has you in front of a flash television interview before you've even left the pitch? That it's I think most rational people can understand sometimes difficult questions need to be asked, but if they're asked in the right way, nobody should fall out.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it's exciting times, and it really is. You mentioned the Bulgaria game there, and I got a kick out of Tony asking him how he was travelling. I'd say he was nearly half hinting himself wouldn't mind knowing how to get there.
But can I just ask you from a player's perspective, like you would have been involved in multiple coaching changes over your career. So like, you know, when it went, say, from Eddie O'Sullivan to Declan Kidney, mm-hmm. to, you know, and even from a domestic level, the time he has with players are so limited. How can you shake things up, or do you have to go with some level of consistency just to get up and running?
I think it's tough. I think you have to get buy-in, which is the greatest thing. And I think that's when you're in any transition, I think there's an element of trust that, you know, you're not there at the start, but for the betterment of everyone, if we can just get qualification secured and then we'll settle down a bit. And that'll actually come with players that will have to exit the squad. If you're really honest with guys, Damien, if you're telling them, look, I'm looking at you for qualification, but I probably am looking at you towards the Euros if we get that far, you know. I think just personally, I feel players respond better to open, honest conversation, and rather than people, you know, just having these kind of, you know, just going, not behind their back, but not making it clear, you know, and I think that's always important, but it'll be interesting.
Yeah, interesting times ahead. We're heading towards half-time in the 3 6 o'clock kickoffs in the English Premier League. Manchester City still leading Newcastle by 2-0. Scoreless between Sheffield United and Wolves. Burnley have taken the lead against West Ham. They lead by 1-0. I should mention, actually, because there are a host of Irish players involved tonight. So Sheffield United, John Egan starts. Enda Stevens starts as well. Matt Doherty starting for Wolves. And from a Burnley perspective, Long in the centre of defence. for them. Robbie Brady is on the bench and Dara O'Shea has scored for West Brom in the Championship. They now lead Derby by 2-0. Break to take and we're chatting tennis on the far side of this. 2FM.
Game on 2FM. With Green Farm. A quick and easy addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein your way. Game on. Tennis.
With the majority of sports getting their house in order for a return to play, it's unusual to see one of the most socially distant and exciting sports like tennis not up and running. Stephen Higgins from the brilliant CrossCourtView.com joins us now to bring us up to speed with all the action, but more importantly, all the off-court drama with Twitter rants, world number ones behaving badly, and a 16-year-old ray of hope that is a credit with and without her racket. Stephen, how's it going?
I suppose as good as you can be for a sport that's shut down for 4 months at this stage.
Yeah, it's not like you're counting the days. 121 days you put down your notes earlier on. You must be starved of action of tennis, Stephen.
Well, you're certainly not starved of drama. I think all the players twiddling their thumbs on social media, they've revealed all sides of their personality, both positive and negative, in the months since.
Yeah, and we'll go into them all, but can we start with Coco Gauff? Because I think she deserves the most credit out of all of them. They've all been behaving in different ways, but she's been, like we say, a ray of hope.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting combination of her and Naomi Osaka that there was a lovely moment last year where Osaka beat Gauff at the US Open, and the moment was a bit too much for Gauff in the second set as Osaka kind of blew her away. But she was on the verge of tears and Osaka brought her into the interview and they did it together. And it was this nice kind of sign of camaraderie in a sometimes vicious sport. But the Black Lives Matter movement has really obviously shone a light on the inequalities between the races. And Coco Gauff, who's still only 16, and Naomi Osaka have been at the forefront of that. So they're kind of inheriting that bar that, say, someone like Martina Navratilova or Billie Jean King have of being outspoken athletes on social issues. And they're extremely impressive. And there's a great speech, if people want to see on YouTube or so, of Coco Gauff to a crowd about a month ago talking about the issues and how they affect her and what she wants. And, you know, she's 16 and she's a tennis player who you think would just be solely focused on tennis. And she's been extremely impressive, just her thoughts and all, for someone so young.
But then the flip side of that, potentially the more entertaining and maybe not quite as rational, Nick Kyrgios has been unbelievable value on Twitter. Probably has too much time on his hands to be at home venting his anger about various things.
The world is really turned upside down because Nick Kyrgios is now the most responsible tennis player on the planet. He, I mean, if you remember back to the Australian Open when he led the appeal for the bushfire crisis and he was at the forefront of that, organising a big charitable tournament. And in the time since, he's been, getting into arguments with Boris Becker. And last night, I mean, this is just brilliant, where people may have heard about this Adria Tour that Novak Djokovic was one of the four runners organising. That turned out to be a disaster in the Adriatic, where they had an exhibition event. Loads of players tested positive, including Djokovic. And Kyrgios has been very critical about that ever since. And last night he was talking again about it, and was it the great criticising the players who were partying like potatoes during a pandemic, which is lovely alliteration. Nothing else.
And you mentioned that there are obviously Boris Becker, renowned and much appreciated within tennis. It's unusual for these two to kind of go at it, isn't it?
Well, Boris Becker, in a really strange series of tweets, was calling, says he didn't like rats. So basically calling Kyrgios a rat, like when you were in primary school or so, giving about someone telling on the teacher. But Kyrgios is absolutely right of this is an extremely serious situation and the players are, you know, at the top of the sport and they have to set an example. And he's absolutely right to call it out, particularly after the Adria Tour.
But you talk about it there, the criticism of the Adria Tour, that the sport as a whole, if we can draw the comparison with horse racing and the pressure that was put on horse racing in Ireland as a result of Cheltenham, which didn't have anything to do with them, that you now look at when the tour eventually does try to get up and running, there's going to be such a focus on competitive tennis as a result of fairly irresponsible behaviour behind, you know, that event a couple of weeks back.
Yeah, but there are a lot of conflicting and concurrent issues at one time. So say, for instance, if you look at one other side of it, that if the sport has to stop until there's a vaccine, what if there isn't a vaccine? So there's that in mind. But tennis, a bit like golf, I think we were talking earlier, is almost uniquely positioned as one of the worst sports afflicted by something like this because of its international reach, because you have thousands of sole traders who move from one destination to another through all these different travel restrictions. And because the situation is so precarious and changing all the time, how can you plan ahead? So say the tours have organized a new calendar to start back from August, like early August or so. But what confidence would you have that any of the events can be held given what's happening day to day?
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it. And just on Damien's point there about, you know, the leaders, Djokovic as a leader, we've seen the likes of Marcus Rashford setting a good standard, but Djokovic here has done a terrible job for the game, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think the thing about the Adria Tour was the almost the brazenness of it, that it's one thing about the restrictions in the stadium. If people saw it, was broadcast on, I think, Eurosport at the time. And in the height of the pandemic, you saw 6,000 or 7,000 fans all packed together in the boiling heat in
and
a stadium.
Players embracing each other.
Yeah, all day. But then boys. Added on the off-hour stuff of dancing in nightclubs, topless, playing basketball, hugging, all this kind of thing. And you're just kind of, what planet are these people on? It was all that additional stuff.
But
as well.
Yes, like we opened the programme tonight talking about the Ryder Cup and the difficult decision that's been made to postpone the Ryder Cup until next year. And I don't know that people often look into the insurance that's at play and host broadcasters and people with tickets. And there's 100 million moving parts. And yet we're in a situation here where we still think we are planning for a US Open and a French Open to still go ahead this year. And you'd wonder just how okay, it's great to have ambitions and it's great to have targets, but how realistic are they?
Well, one thing just on the Ryder Cup, I suppose, is I remember going to it when it was here in the K Club. The Ryder Cup is uniquely one of those things where it's all about the fans. Mm. Like the entire thing is about the fans, so it's very hard to run that without them. A tennis actually can run without fans, because if anyone follows the tour route, there are a lot of tournaments around the world at the time where there aren't really any fans. And particularly lower down, you'll have very few people. At the moment, they've rescheduled for a US Open at the end of August and a French Open at the end of September. The US Open will have very strict protocols, no spectators, restrictions on the number of people who can go in terms of entourage and practice, etc. Roland Garros is very ambitiously looking at something like 50 to 60% of a crowd, which I don't see how that will really work. But all these predictions and projections, I just think you have no real confidence in it because things are fluctuating so much. Say even the case in Melbourne where they've embarked on a 6-week lockdown now. Mm. There is consideration that Roland Garros might go ahead, but there might not be another Grand Slam until Roland Garros next year because of the problems just of travel and fear of it.
Yeah, and you mentioned it there, Stephen. It's like sole traders. So like putting the betterment of the whole sport ahead is quite difficult, but it shows the grow for tennis in France when you see that, you know, the soccer got cancelled, the rugby got cancelled. No way they were cancelling the tennis.
I think there is another side to it in that while the Adria Tour has gotten so much attention, there have been successful exhibitions held with the strict protocols, like Jamie Murray's Battle of the Brits tournament and Patrick Mouratoglou's Ultimate Tennis Showdown, where they just had basically no spectators, one umpire, possibly coaches, and a really barren court, and a small group of players in one location. It is doable on those terms, but the problem comes with obviously bigger tournaments with more prize money, ranking points. How can you host Grand Slams in that scenario?
And that is the big issue, isn't it? With regard to, obviously a decision has been made to freeze rankings, but how long do you kick that down the road? And if it comes to a situation where certain players can't enter certain countries to take part in certain events, how do you have an equitable ranking system?
Yeah, I think they've actually done a good job, the ATP, in terms of it's the best way they could do it of no one really loses their ranking because it's frozen. And if you want to go out and play, you can get some credit for it. But the big issue, as you say, is the sole traders. There are governing bodies. There are thousands of people who are just running their own lives. And it's very hard to corral them into following the behaviour. And I personally would just think that because of the precarious situation, we should kind of just write off the rest of the year, support the tournaments with funding obviously from the main body, but you have to plan for next year of what are we going to do if there isn't a vaccine, as you probably would expect. How are you going to organize some sort of tour? It looks very difficult.
Stephen, I know we're tight on time and you'll never get to explain all the rankings, but what they're looking at doing now is putting it into a 22-month calendar, is that right?
Yeah, so it's your best 18 tournaments over the course of 22 months. They only count your best of the same. So say Rafa Nadal won Roland Garros in the US Open last year, he wouldn't get any credit, sadly, if he won them both again this year, which means that they are releasing them from the responsibility that if he doesn't want to play the tournaments, he isn't hindered by that. But if you didn't do so well at the end of last year, you can improve your ranking.
It's like when you repeat the leave and then you swap one for the other. Or certainly that's how it was back in my day. Just to finish, one thing that perhaps got lost in a lot of the coverage was, like, Roger Federer, who is as big a weight in terms of discussion and topics as you will find, talking very openly about the prospect of uniting the two tours and having one single entity. Is it going to be the start of a solid conversation about that now, do you think?
Well, it was in the weeks after he said it. Now, in fairness, Billie Jean King was advocating for this decades ago. So he's kind of joined the conversation along with Andy Murray. It makes a lot of sense given the bargaining power that they would have and the issues of organising fully equal prize money across the tournaments, particularly in the years ahead where it'll be very difficult to navigate this stretch. That it obviously just makes a lot of sense for two of them to be united. And bear in mind, there isn't a players' union at the moment, which again, doesn't make a lot of sense.
Stephen Higgins from crosscourtview.com. Thanks so much.
Game on 2FM.